regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. It is April 1st. We're not doing any April Fool's stuff here on the program. I hate April Fool's Day. I've hated April Fool's Day since I was a kid. I hated it then. I hate it now. I don't think the fake news stories are funny. Anyway, I guess I'm just a grumpy guy when it comes to April Fool's. So we're just going to play it straight on today's program. And we're going to be talking with Second Amendment attorney Amy Bellantoni from New York about a victory in a long-lasting case challenging New York City's licensing laws, not for carrying a firearm, but for keeping a firearm in your home, both a handgun as well as rifles and shotguns. It took a while to get here, but the city has been forced to cough up some money to an individual who was denied a permit, at least in the beginning. He eventually got his permits, and now he's getting some money as well. That's sort of the jumping off point for a larger conversation with Amy about how things have changed for the worse since the Bruin decision. And I ultimately asked her, you know, do you think things are better or worse overall since the Bruin decision came down? And Amy, who deals with these issues on a daily basis, said she thinks that things are actually worse for gun owners now in New York State than they were, you know, 4 years ago at this time before the Supreme Court struck down New York's May issue licensing laws. It's a fascinating and somewhat depressing conversation, I'll be honest with you. But thankfully, we do have folks like Amy fighting the good fight there in the Empire State. Take a look and a listen. Amy, thanks so much for joining me on the program today. It's good to see you.
Great to see you again, too.
And congratulations. This is really exciting. So this is a case that we're going to be talking about called Srower versus New York City. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
It's Srower versus New York City.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And this was a case dealing with New York City's licensing laws, right?
Correct. Yes. Yes. We were challenging the handgun statute as well as the rifle shotgun permitting scheme. Amazingly, in New York City, you need a permit, you need permission, which is discretionary for both types of firearms, you know, in order to possess them. So.
Okay. And so what happened with this case? Because it kind of went, I mean, you had the trial court decision, it went up to the Second Circuit, then went back down to the trial court. So what happened throughout all of this, throughout its long journey through the legal system here?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. So just the thumbnail sketch, Mr. Srower had applied for a handgun permit for his home, to have handguns in his home, as well as a rifle shotgun permit in 2018. And in 2019, he was denied by the New York City License Division based on his driving history. And he had two prior arrests that had been sealed, dismissed and sealed by the court. So we brought a lawsuit in the Southern District of New York in federal court. It was assigned to Judge John Cronin, who has just been remarkable in his interpretation and actual application of the Constitution and the Supreme Court precedent on Second Amendment issues. On October 23rd of 2024, Judge Cronin granted our motion for summary judgment, meaning that he granted us liability. We won the case against New York City. It was a watershed moment. He held that the handgun licensing scheme in New York City and the rifle shotgun licensing scheme were both imbued with broad, so much discretion, like such broad discretion. He didn't even get into the subsections because we only challenged particular subsections of the handgun scheme. But, you know, on its face, it was so overly broad and discretionary that he found it to be facially unconstitutional. Wow. So just as an aside, we had facial challenges. We started out with an as-applied challenge, but there was no need. So I had withdrawn the as-applied challenges, and we went forward with the facial challenge. In the meantime, while the case was pending, New York City amended the preamble to its handgun licensing scheme, which now that it's an amendment, can't be enjoined because now we're dealing with a completely different statute. So with regard to liability, yes, on the handgun licensing scheme, we have liability. But then because it had been amended, there was nothing for the district court to enjoin or to strike going forward because it was no longer in existence.
Okay.
Yeah. But with regard to the rifle shotgun licensing scheme, still, they didn't amend that and we were successful and he did enjoin it permanently, but he stayed the injunction to allow the city to go to the Second Circuit. The city goes to the Second Circuit. While the appeal is pending, they issue my client his rifle shotgun license and handgun license, and then make the claim to the Second Circuit that the case is now moot. So they appealed and then argued their own appeal was moot. And most interestingly, and most importantly, they argued that the injunction imposed on the rifle shotgun statute should be vacated. I argued that it shouldn't be vacated. Basically, it was held to be unconstitutional. And why would any court want to keep an unconstitutional law on the books? But apparently they did, and they vacated the injunction of the rifle shotgun statute. So the case went back, and we held, Judge Cronin held a trial on damages in May of 2025. And as a result of that trial, he rendered a decision on Monday that I believe, and he also indicated in his opinion that he believes, that this is the first time that there has been an award of monetary damages in a Second Amendment case. So it's very exciting. And he did a phenomenal job in his analysis of, you know, from the hearing.
This is exciting.
It's very exciting.
And I got to ask, I mean, with the Second Circuit, so was, did Judge Cronin rule that the shotgun and rifle permitting process was also facially unconstitutional?
Yes, he did. Yes. There were two subsections that we attacked. One, the good moral character clause, which is not restrained at all. New York State kind of narrowed their definition of good moral character for their handgun licensing scheme to what the Second Circuit calls to be a proxy for dangerousness. New York City followed suit with the handguns. But with regard to rifle shotgun licensing, it's still good moral character and there is there's no cap on it. It's utterly boundless. And we also challenged, so it was subsection 2 and we challenged subsection 9, which was the, we can deny you for any good cause. The city, interestingly, didn't appeal the any good cause. So we did prevail, you know, and that is enjoined.
Okay.
But they did appeal the good cause, I'm sorry, the good moral character requirement. So that is still on the books and still being applied to others for rifles and shotguns, which have never been licensed ever. So
that is amazing to me. And because that does seem to fly in the face of the Bruin decision, right? Which, I mean, again, if you, the Supreme Court said you can't have these sort of arbitrary and capricious rules here that can just be applied so broadly. If there is no definition of good moral character, how on earth can the Second Circuit say that that actually is akin to a shall issue licensing regime?
Right. So, you know, and it's funny because after the Bruin decision, the city and the state continue to maintain that we have a shall issue regime. Nothing changed with regard to the language of the licensing statute's preamble, which says no license shall issue except for those who blah, blah, blah. And one of those blah, blah, blahs being, you know, has good moral character. So in the Antonyuk decision, essentially the Second Circuit held that, it's not boundless discretion. It's narrow. And there is a history of, you know, the government deciding who can and who cannot have firearms based on dangerousness. So they kind of bootstrapped objective, bright line disqualifiers to allow this squishy, subjective rule to continue to exist.
So can that portion, this has been fully briefed and tried, right? So
over. Yeah.
Okay. So there's no opportunity for this to go to the Supreme Court. Did you file a cert petition with the Supreme Court on this?
We did. Yeah, we did file a petition based on the vacator of the unconstitutional statute. But that cert was denied. So the only and I've been thinking about how it could possibly get back there. I've never, I haven't faced this type of situation before. I guess theoretically, if the city appeals, there may be room for a cross appeal or an argument. I mean, I can't really appeal Judge Cronin's decision, which is favorable.
Right.
And the Second Circuit decision which was unfavorable, was kind of an interlocutory, situation, which I know the Supreme Court isn't crazy about. So I really honestly don't know if there's an avenue to jump off from the Second Circuit should the city decide to appeal.
I don't know. Well, and New York and the city of New York has made it difficult. For years, right? I mean, going back even pre-Bruin, the previous challenge regarding transporting firearms, when that case, New York defended that law right up until it was appealed to the Supreme Court. Then, we're going to change it, and now the whole case is moot, right? So.
Right.
They did sort of the same thing, it sounds like, when it comes to the handgun licensing in your case, when they get into trouble. Well, let's just put a new amendment in there. Now it's a new statute. And now the case is mooted out.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was a huge disappointment when that occurred, because really nothing changed. There's still discretion. So I guess, Judge Cronin, rightfully so, took the cautious approach to say it really technically is a different statute now. I don't know if it's challenged again. I'm not sure how far they could get. I mean, how many times are they going to reword their statute? At some point, it just gets silly. Bruin decision was very clear with respect to discretion and, assessing facts. And, now with the Concealed Carry Act, the in-person interview, and now someone's going to, look you over and ask you questions. I had a person contact me who had gone for a pistol license in Westchester County and had gone before a judge who quizzed him on all of the areas in New York State that are considered sensitive places. And who, of course, he couldn't name all 200. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but,
right.
So there's an 18-hour course that requires 16 hours of classroom time and 2 hours of live fire where you're taught these sensitive areas. And I mean, ignorance of the law is no excuse. It's this whole nanny state mentality that we have to guide you. You're too dangerous. You're not responsible. We have to tell you what you can do, where you can carry. These are natural laws. These are natural rights. I have the right to defend myself. You can call something a sensitive area, but I still have the right to defend my life if someone's attacking me in your defined sensitive area. So because he couldn't come up with all of the sensitive areas, I think he came up with, a few or a handful, she denied his pistol license. So this is this in-person quizzing and this discretion that really should be taken away from the judges, because they, I have a case pending now that's trying to break through this whole immunity shield that they're resting behind, because they're violating 88% of New York's geography or population. Well, I can't say population, geography, because most of the counties are the judges are the licensing officials, so they can just do really whatever they want. The state the appellate divisions aren't following the narrowed scope of the good moral character requirement. And now with this, you have to come and see me in person, and I can just quiz you like a child about what I think is important. It's out of hand. It's out of hand. It should be like you go in, you have a NICS check done. If you're not a prohibited person, you leave, in 15 minutes, and that's it. I mean, aside from the fact that I just don't think there should be permitting at all. Right. I mean, I completely disagree with the whole concept, but if there's going to be permitting, that's what a shall issue state is. It's a very quick and simple process, not this nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, I knock on wood, that's how the process will remain in Virginia. I now that the Democrats are in charge, I don't know. That
but kids are back in the office. Yeah. Right.
But that has been throughout the entire time I've lived in Virginia. And you're right. I mean, I'm with you. I don't think permitting is constitutional, but the Supreme Court disagrees with that and has said shall issue permitting is okay. But what you just described is shall issue, right? You go in, there's no disqualifier, you pass a background check, you can legally keep a gun. All right, you can legally carry that gun. No big deal, right? But, you know, in New York, since Bruin, I mean, before Bruin, the state was may issue, right? But a lot of counties sort of had this ad hoc shall issue approach. There weren't nearly as many sensitive places. But when New York State was basically told, okay, you can't deny 98% of the people who apply, well, that's when all of a sudden the state decided, okay, if we can't block most people from carrying, we can at least stop them from carrying in most places.
Right, exactly. I mean, the comment during oral argument that they can't make Manhattan, the whole island of Manhattan, a sensitive place. Well, you know, I guess the governor took that to mean, well, I'll just make the whole state a sensitive place. And I think there's some clip somewhere where she is asked the question, well, where can people carry, you know, with these new laws? And her quip was something to the effect of, well, I'm sure there's some place, some street somewhere, you know, that's right. That's unacceptable. It's unacceptable.
No, and again, I mean, you know, New York treats carrying a firearm without a carrying a loaded firearm without a concealed carry license as a violent felony, right? I mean, that's
yes,
mandatory minimum 3.5 years behind bars, unless maybe you're the nepo baby of a celebrity. I saw Cyndi Lauper's son magically had his a gun possession case, I guess, sent to pretrial diversion. If he keeps his nose clean, then it's wiped completely off the record. But you've got, you know, plenty of folks who are serving time in prison for the crime of bearing arms without a government permission slip. No violence.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't even know how just the mere possession or the mere carriage of firearm is even a crime. I mean, it's a natural right. It's in the simplest and most succinct amendment that's been codified in our Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And, you know, if you're not a prohibited person and you're not in a traditionally considered sensitive area, meaning a courthouse, you know, I have a summer camp challenge right now, a summer camp ban up in upstate New York. And having done the research, there really isn't even any support for schools as a sensitive area. From the historical research that's come out from that case, this whole concept began in colleges. The colleges were private. It was not government action. So that's not an historical tradition. They weren't laws. They were administrative regulations. They didn't ban the public from carrying or possessing firearms. They prevented the students. The punishment was fines or suspension from school or expulsion. It was not you're a felon and you're now going to jail and now we're taking your Second Amendment right away from you. So these quips that, oh, schools and courthouses and, you know, there's a long litany of places that are being thrown out there as there's a historical tradition and everyone's just, you know, hearing the soundbite and signing on. But that's not the reality from the historical perspective that has, you know, come out of these cases.
Yeah. I'd love to delve into that more deeply with you in a future conversation, because you're right. I mean, that has not only have we seen that apply to schools, but you're now seeing that logic applied to, you know, I think the Seventh Circuit in upholding the ban on carrying on public transportation. Said that there's a historical tradition of banning guns in crowded public spaces where vulnerable populations exist. And vulnerable, they mean children. So
yes.
Any place in public where kids might be found. And the analogy that they drew was to schools.
Yes.
And so, I mean, we're seeing this, you know, widespread abuse. So can we have you back in the near future and kind of talk about the history that you found as you've been going through this particular case?
Yeah, I would love to do that. I would. And I think that, you know, the leaders of New York and you know, Illinois and California and all these crazy states, I think they, you know, have, you know, morning Zoom conferences regularly because they all express the same mantra. Vulnerable people. Oh, it was, yeah, and I would love to come back, but just as an aside, mm-hmm. you know, with this whole, we have to protect the children. That was the whole, you know, basis of the camp, owners and the adult staff, not everyone, you know, can't be, it's a Jewish summer camp, by the way, and they've been subject to threats and harassment for decades, you know, in upstate New York. But that being said, you know, we have to protect the vulnerable children. Well, you know, there's a carve out for rifle target shooting in the statute. So clearly they're not averse to allowing children to have possession of firearms. But in some of the research that I had done, I think it was, I want to say Thomas Jefferson, but there were so many stories of, you know, people in the colonial times and killed kids, you know, bringing their guns to school, 10-year-olds serving in the you know, even back to the Civil War, you know, and the idea that children were seen back then the way children are seen today, it's a misconception. They were not seen as little vulnerable things. They were treated as just mini adults. They were, you know, the laws that existed back then were laws that came about later on in the 1800s, were laws to eventually keep kids from accessing firearms and not selling firearms. But the case isn't about the children possessing firearms. It's about the responsible adults who are licensed, you know, possessing firearms to be able to protect them from, you know, God forbid, another October 7th, you know, on American soil. So, yeah, it's nuts.
It is absolutely nuts. Just one last question for you. You know, I mean, honestly, when you look at everything that we've seen and all of the laws that New York has put in place over the past few years, do you think things have gotten better or worse in New York since the Bruin decision?
I think they've gotten worse. I do. I think the whole, I've expressed to you before, I'm not really sure why the Bruin decision had to discuss or place I think it's a perceived imprimatur on licensing. Mm-hmm. I think they just sought to clarify in their decision that they weren't eradicating licensing. I really don't believe that they put their imprimatur on licensing. Licensing of handguns didn't even come about until the very, very late 1800s, early 1900s, well after the ratification of the Bill of Rights. And so not reflective at all and completely inconsistent with the plain text and the history of the Second Amendment. So I think, like they will, the anti-freedom government people just take whatever they can and blow it up like a balloon and, you know, and run with it, because that's exactly what has happened, you know. And during the whole, and again, they collaborate, like during the whole time that the Bruin decision was pending, we didn't have a decision yet, the Bruin case, you know, and we know this because Governor Hochul came out and said, we've been preparing, her and the legislature and every town and, you know, all the people in those niche groups prepared so that they could combat the Supreme Court. I mean, she blatantly said that, and she was very proud of her, you know, sensitive places and restrictive areas like that. Thank goodness was stricken, the restrictive areas where you couldn't go onto someone's private property unless they had a sign that said you can carry firearms on this property. It was a, you know, completely upside down approach to individual rights. But yes, before it was difficult to get a concealed carry license. Yes, it absolutely was. But now, like she said, just like she said, Governor Hochul, now you have it, but now you can't carry it anywhere.
Yeah.
So
and exactly, it's still not particularly easy to get a concealed carry license. So you still have the difficulties in getting one. And now you've got all of the added, you know, gun-free zones and all of the associated gun control laws. Amy, thank you for fighting the good fight up there in New York. I imagine that you are awfully busy these days, and so I appreciate you carving out some time for us today. And I'll get back with you, and we'll figure out a time where we can kind of delve into the history of or the lack thereof of some of these gun control laws.
Yeah, I would love that. Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to be on your show. And I look forward to being here again.
Yeah, well, we'll do it again very soon. Amy Bellantoni joining us here on Bearing Arms Cam & Company. My thanks to Amy for joining us on the program. And we will be talking with her again next Thursday about the history that she has found. I'm fascinated by this because, you know, it's technically it's up to the state. If a gun law implicates the Second Amendment, then it's up to the state to justify that law through historic analogs. But as we've seen, courts have just gone out of their way to say that things that are not really analogous are, in fact, because you know, they quote Rahimi, well, law doesn't have to be trapped in amber, doesn't have to be an identical twin. Okay, but you can't just say, well, there was a law that dealt with firearm possession back in 1791. This law deals with firearm possession today. There's the analog. You can't do that. It doesn't have to be the exact same statute, but generally speaking, the how and the why must be the same. What was the problem that they were trying to address, and how do they try to address it? Right? That needs to be the same. And I'm fascinated by what Amy says she's discovered when it comes to banning firearms in schools, because it really has been abused by courts across the country to now say, you know, in any place where children might possibly be. That's been used to uphold bans on firearms in parks and playgrounds so parents can't protect their kids, in museums, as I mentioned in talking with Amy, public transportation. And if all of that is based on bad history, well, that means that all of those bans are unconstitutional. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of Michigan where a Milford man has been bound over in two armed robbery cases. As it turns out, this is not this individual's first rodeo. 37-year-old James Arthur Michael Trammell, now being held in the Oakland County Jail on $2 million bond. He was bound over to the Oakland County Circuit Court earlier this month in two separate cases, including armed robbery and felony firearms for robberies in Commerce Township and Lyon Township. He was at the time on parole for a previous armed robbery conviction. He was arrested on March the 9th. He's accused of robbing a store called Intimate Ideas. I wonder what they sell. Back on February 22nd, officer, the police there in Commerce Township said that he held the clerk at knife point, tried to stab the clerk before fleeing with an undisclosed amount of cash. And then just about a week later, February 28th, he's accused of robbing Wild Bill's Tobacco Shop in Lyon Township. In that case, he is alleged to have held a gun to the head of the clerk and demanding money before he fled from the store. According to WHMI, Trammell has multiple felony convictions on his record dating back to 2006, including, again, that previous conviction for armed robbery, larceny of a firearm, receiving and concealing stolen firearms, possession of a controlled substance. Oakland County Sheriff Michael Bouchard said that he appreciated the diligence and hard work of the detectives, as well as the partnership with the Michigan Department of Corrections, as well as the tips coming in from the public to take Trammell into custody. Saying that this combination, quote, allowed us to take a dangerous career criminal off the street. I guess now the question is for how long, right? I mean, if this guy's got a lengthy criminal history going back 20 years now, multiple felony convictions, and he's still out and about, how long do we possibly think he's going to get for these, if he's convicted for these two armed robberies? Prosecutors have filed for an enhanced sentence in these cases. Maybe it's going to get granted. Maybe it's not. But honestly, given Mr. Trammell's rap sheet, that enhanced sentence should have happened long ago. On to today's armed citizen story from Tulsa, Oklahoma, where police have not officially concluded their investigation. I was actually kind of surprised to see that they released a statement about this case that is still under investigation. But they did. It was the shooting death of a man named Sean Six in Tulsa. Police originally said the case looked like self-defense, and now in their update, they say, yes, it still appears to be self-defense. Sean Six's family disagrees with that. But according to Tulsa police, this individual, Sean Six, lived with his girlfriend in a home, but Six had moved out. Police say that hours after he left, he then came back after making threats. And he tried to break in through a window. Was not able to do that, so then he kicked in a door. He went past his girlfriend to a back bedroom, confronted a man, who then shot and killed Six. According to Lieutenant Brandon Watkins with the Tulsa Police Homicide Unit, he says, you know, we don't just walk in and take somebody's word for it that this is self-defense, because a big chunk of our homicides, people try to claim self-defense. That doesn't necessarily mean that we believe it. But he says that they've watched a video, surveillance video online. They've watched or they've interviewed multiple witnesses. He says that, though, quote, we're literally looking at everything that's out there and everything that is available. He says, again, there's a lot of information that the public doesn't have on this particular case. And there's also a lot of speculation out there on this particular case that is just wrong. Now, Six's family, again, says that he did not move out of the house. They think that the girlfriend of the man who fired the shots lured Six back to the home. And I understand. I mean, listen, I don't know anything other than what the family said, other than what the police have said, and other than what local media in Tulsa has reported. But I do understand that when a loved one is shot and killed, particularly under these circumstances, right? You might know your son or your brother or your father as a kind, loving individual, right? It just seems completely out of character to me. But sometimes people can act out of character. And unfortunately, we have seen cases where individuals who don't have a criminal history, don't have a history of violence, become violent in that moment. And again, I don't know what the police investigation will ultimately conclude. But right now, the Tulsa Police Department say they plan on handing the case over to the district attorney within a week. They say that they do continue to receive additional information. They are continuing to investigate those leads and talk to witnesses. But as of right now, they say that the shooting does appear to be a case of self-defense. So we'll keep our eyes open and give you any more information as it becomes available. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing able to do the right thing. A good Samaritan in Florida who reunited a puppy with her owner. The dog actually apparently dumped after the car that it was in was stolen in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. This is from Channel 10 in, I guess, the Fort Lauderdale area. Carol Callagher is the owner of her puppy. She had been visiting a friend Monday afternoon when her vehicle was stolen. Surveillance video showed a dark-colored sedan pull alongside Callagher's Bentley. Person wearing black clothing and white pants then runs off to the car and then eventually drives off in the Bentley. Callagher said her poodle puppy, Coco, was inside the car at the time of the theft. And then authorities later determined that the puppy was thrown from the car during the incident, which I hope if they catch this person, they face charges of animal cruelty as well. But Coco was picked up by a neighbor who brought the puppy to a local veterinarian. When Channel 10 News broadcast a report about the car theft and the missing puppy, the neighbor actually watched that report, realized, oh, my gosh, now we know who the owner of the dog is. Callagher said, you know, we thought the worst. We didn't want to keep hope going. She said, my husband kept saying, it'll play out, it'll play out. She said, it played out well. Just look at this. Authorities do say the suspects at this point remain at large. Callagher's car has not yet been recovered, but honestly, sounds like she is more concerned about and more relieved to get her puppy back. So I'm glad that Good Samaritan took in that puppy. Glad that the puppy's okay. And glad that Callagher has been reunited with her pooch. So in the right place, at the right time, willing able to do the right thing. That anonymous Good Samaritan stepping in to save the day and reunite a dog and its owner. We thank you for your very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company, and I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. They're keeping you up to date on all kinds of Second Amendment news and information, including information from overseas. You know, yesterday we were talking about the abysmal start to Canada's compensated confiscation program. Well, things aren't any better down under. The Australian gun buyback plan that was announced by the Prime Minister after the Bondi Beach terror attacks, not going over well with more than half of the Australian states. So we've got that story. And, of course, the latest news from state capitals here at home, pro-gun bills, bad gun bills, and more. It's all waiting for you there at BearingArms.com. Have a great rest of your Hump Day Wednesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.